everybody. Welcome to the Fearless Paranoia Podcast, where we are demystifying the complex world of cybersecurity. I am Brian, the cybersecurity attorney.
And I'm Ryan. I'm a cybersecurity architect.
And today we're going to be talking about the re-rise of the great scourge of ransomware. One interesting thing happened as a result of the pandemic was that ransomware actually started to decline. In 2021, the number of ransomware attacks was down. In 2022, even though the number ticked up slightly, the dollar amount taken by ransomware dropped considerably. There were a number of potential factors that caused this, among them being increased security, finally catching up to the realities of the pandemic. I think IT finally got a chance to catch up to some of the glaring security holes that the pandemic caused. We also had the, I'd say, free fall in value of Bitcoin, which was incredibly important given that it was the payment method of choice for ransomware gangs, given its near anonymous exchange system. So what we have seen, though, in the past probably 18 to 24 months is a considerable rise in new ransomware attacks. And I do think it's appropriate to differentiate new ransomware from the traditional ransomware we had been dealing with. Now, we talked two episodes ago about the double and triple and quadruple extortion ransomware and how that development has been changing the field of ransomware. And in reality, that has been going on for longer than 2 or 3 years, but it has really come to the fore now. In fact, I would argue that the modern ransomware relies more heavily on the exfiltration than on the simple locking up of your tools. But there are a bunch of additional features of modern ransomware that really do distinguish it from the kind of ransomware that we all became acquainted with in the 20-teens when this really took off. And we're going to talk about it in a few different ways, but I'm going to break it down primarily into two major discussions. The first is the nature of ransomware itself and talking about ransomware as a... So, Ryan, first I want to start off and get your thoughts on this modern evolution of ransomware. The past year saw the largest dollar amount ever in payouts to ransomware at a time when we have states passing laws here in the U.S. saying that government entities are no longer allowed to pay any ransom. You have insurance companies with do not pay clauses built right into all of their policies, and yet ransomware gangs have collected more than they ever have before. All of this at a time where enforcement is at a record high and the number of ransomware gangs that are being broken apart by international law enforcement and having their decryption keys published to the internet seems to be a weekly event. What's going on?
Well, the game's changing, and that's really what it is. So, you know, I think what most businesses are finding out nowadays is that ransomware itself, like the way traditional ransomware really started, where it was they get in, they lock up your systems, you pay the ransom, you get the key, you unlock your systems, you go back about your business, or you properly test your DR planning and then work to restore operations. One way or another, it was usually that simple, right? It was that one-sided. The ransomware event and then recovery from the ransomware event. That was really the long and the short of it.
And I remember one of the big things about those early ransomware things, the fact that the ransomware gangs only had to go in and lock up your stuff, didn't take anything out. And the fact that the ransoms were actually early on were somewhat reasonable. Both of those things were a feature for the ransomware gangs because by not exfiltrating your data and by keeping the ransoms under a certain amount, they managed to, for a good number of years, avoid significant law enforcement activity. In fact, in 2012, the FBI basically, they published advice to businesses saying, look, you got any question? If you think you have to pay the ransom, pay the ransom, because this is not rising to a level that we're interested in. That was a feature, but that's absolutely no longer the case.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. And for a couple main reasons. First of all, the nature of the attacks and the depth of the attacks, as we talked about in previous episodes, has changed. So now instead of just that basic ransomware attack, now you have, again, exfiltration of data, which can be social-based data, it can be PII, other protected information, it could be source code, trade secrets, etc. It could be customer lists, it could be a whole variety of different things, but just the identification of the value in those data sets helped change the game and help escalate the game from the threat actor side. It gave them new targets that they could use to directly monetize if they so choose to, or it also gave them a target or an object to use as the source of extortion or blackmail, etc. something to levy pressure against the victims.
It almost strikes me as like that scene from The Godfather where they're discussing whether or not they should all start selling drugs when one of the mob bosses says, for so long, we used to pay our people to not sell drugs. But now when they can, for $5,000, they can make a $50,000 profit, they can't resist. So we'll do it.
So it is, yeah, the game in that aspect has changed. The other part of the game that's changed significantly that has led to kind of the rise in intensity of the attacks and the damage that they cause to the victims is the distribution of the operational chain of ransomware. And that's a big convoluted term, but basically what that means to me, or what I'm trying to describe, is that in the past it was a single gang that would take care of ransomware, right? You would have somebody who would figure out how to get into a business, either social engineering or whatever method they could use, and then they would get in, they would deploy the ransomware, they would send the messaging, they would collect the funds, they would have to mule the funds around and cash them out. It was kind of, each gang was kind of on their own, right? They had, you know, a limited set of people just kind of doing the few things. And a lot of times it was either ripped off ransomware or variants of just commonly known ransomware that were kind of getting used. And a lot of them were getting fingerprinted pretty quickly too, as quickly as they could. But now we've distributed that whole operation. And so now what you have is you have a gang of people that just focus on initial intrusion or initial access. And these are access brokers. And all they do is go around and find ways to break into businesses, collect credentials, or collect ways in, keys basically, into a business. And then they put those up for sale. And then so if they can get away from that point uncaught, well, they're effectively able to provide a solid service right there, right? They just sell access to a business. And then you get ransomware gangs, which sit up at the top tier. They produce ransomware. They've got programmers, coders, people that can do other validation, that can actually train and deal with, like, you know, train people on how to deploy the ransomware, how to move around laterally in a business. They have customer service operations that take the calls from victims, that, you know, actually work them through how to deploy the key to recover their systems, how to access Bitcoin and be able to send the funds over to pay the ransom, etc. But then they stay away from the actual operations, and it helps kind of disconnect them from a large portion of the actual blame. And then they have their affiliate networks. So now you've got somebody who can purchase the, you know, effectively a copy of the ransomware from this large ransomware group. They don't have to be a programmer developer. All they have to do is go grab a copy of something they know that works, that's well-funded and well-created, and then can go purchase initial access to a business that's preferably on the approved list of the threat actor of the ransomware gang. And then they go in and they use the initial access they purchased. They deploy the ransomware, they deploy the ransom, and then they give a cut back to the ransomware gang. And so it's this really kind of just cute, full, well-rounded extortion operation, multi-department, very distributed, but they all kind of work towards that same goal, which is profiting heavily off of the misery of others.
You're listening to the Fearless Paranoia Podcast. For more information on keeping yourself, your family, and your company protected against cyber threats, check out the Resilient Cybersecurity and Data Privacy blog. If you're enjoying this podcast, please like and subscribe using any of your favorite podcast platforms. Also, please share this podcast with anyone you think would find it helpful or useful. We rely on listeners like you to help get the word out about this show, and we appreciate the support. Now, time for some more cybersecurity. Obviously, what you're describing here is what any of us who took economics in high school or 101 college, it's basic specialization.
Mm-hmm.
This is your, I mean, it's diversifying your portfolio and capitalizing on economic advantage. You aren't necessarily going to do the one thing that is most profitable. You're going to do the one thing that you can do the best that also makes you the most money. So if someone else does something better than you, you find something that you do better than them. And is it just from the profit side, or is it that the defense against ransomware has gotten better such that every component of ransomware now has to be so good that you need expert level programmers who just program?
Well, I'd say to some extent, like, that's helpful, but I don't even think we're at a point. I mean, I think the state of cybersecurity as a whole is probably poor enough that they really don't need that level of intense expertise. I think to me, what it comes down to is you can get a major reduction in overall risk by distributing the entire operation. Right. If you can get one group that is effectively just sitting around programming ransomware, running an affiliate network and whatnot, I mean, it's really tough to levy a lot of heavy, heavy charges solely against them because they haven't had direct impact on some of these victims, right? It's So who goes after them? Who's the one to take them down, even though they're at the top and they're causing all the problem? Because you can't tie them necessarily directly to their affiliate network. The affiliates are the ones out doing the actual job.
Yeah, absent a RICO charge, which is a pretty tough charge to actually convict on.
And let's be honest. So then you go after the affiliates. The affiliates are typically lower level folk, right? These are the distributors. These are not the brain trust. These are not the major financiers. These are not the organizers of any of these major activities. These are just the doers, right? These are the ground pounders that are going out and actually carrying the majority of the risk and then shedding off a portion of the profit for the right to do it and for the tools. And so when you bust a few of those people, those are the easiest to train. They're the easiest to replace. They're the easiest to recruit for the most part. Yet they provide this large wall of fodder in front of most of the real criminals.
And probably with no leverageable information in reality either. It's not like in the mafia. The feds used to, the idea was you arrest someone, you flip them, and you get them to give them the person above them. But if you don't really have that connection, or if, for example, that connection is a programmer in Slovenia dealing with a ransomware gang that operates out of Eastern Russia that also, you know, sources out of Mongolia and China, who are you going to get to flip on? Who are you going to arrest the person who you've just incriminated?
And a lot of the criminals, especially the ones we deal with here in the United States or throughout the European Union and some of the other kind of affiliated countries, I guess, you see the majority of them tend to come from areas that are outside of extradition, right? So, I mean, you get a lot of the major ones are sitting in Russia, which, again, gives us very, very little that we can actually do against those top tiers, right? And they spread a pretty good message, especially when they'll take from an affiliate. They'll take something like 15, 20, 25%, and they let the affiliate maintain 70, 75, 80% of the overall take, and they give them all the tools and weapons they need to go charging right in. It's a pretty attractive thing, especially for somebody that, you know, has a little bit of computer knowledge, some basic desire, and maybe a rough time finding something more legitimate to do.
And needs an income.
Yep.
Well, let me ask you this then. This is a little bit off topic, but okay, so Black Cat, we know, is Russian. If they're not actually Russian government, we know they're at least sponsored by and protected by the Russian security services. So they've been doing a lot lately. Among their biggest targets recently have been U.S. hospital groups, but they also are apparently have been identified as the group responsible for hacking some of Fulton County, Georgia, and threatening to release, I don't know what they could possibly release that would be damaging it in what way in the Trump and others case that's pending in Georgia. But, you know, witness testimony could obviously be among them. That would be potentially very dangerous for those witnesses. Could also imperil the testimony in general. They could alter or whatever they want to do. What is ever going to happen? At what point are we going to hit a threshold in the U.S. with ransomware gangs operating out of Russia, operating not just Russia's not just casting a blind eye. Russia is actively supporting these groups. Is there a threshold we're going to reach where it actually becomes an international incident in your mind?
Yeah. I'm no Nostradamus by any means, but I think that there's too many security vulnerabilities out there broadly that could be hugely damaging to actual human beings outside of just financial damage, outside of reputational damage. I think that we've heard a lot of talk lately about critical infrastructure being potentially impacted in large ways, yet no one's ever actively done anything major yet, at least nothing with like drinking water and some of those other kind of core critical systems. There was one attempt that failed back in Florida in like 21 or something a few years ago, but it was a failed attempt.
I think you're right in the broad strokes thing, but just imagine leaking to, even if it's a selective leak, the leak of information was only to selected people, the jury list for any one of potential trials in the Trump case so that the potential jurors could be contacted or the actual jurors could potentially be deduced by anyone who is able to see any of the jurors in real life as they come and go from the courthouse. You're talking about literally putting individual lives in danger there, just like publishing the police reports that identify testifying witnesses or anything like that. This is not small time stuff that's being released. Individual lives, at least, are being put in danger by some of this stuff. And it does seem to be being released in the most sort of callous, wanton fashion possible.
You know, and I think that as long as the impact and there's going to be no clean way to say any of this. I think as long as the impact remains relatively low, as in volume of impacted people or, I mean, severity of the impact overall.
Basically, as long as they don't take on the wrong person or hit the wrong person. So you probably never know when the person you go after is going to be that next one. You know, is it going to be the person that, you know, do you kidnap the the Lindbergh's baby, you know, on accident or on purpose.
Yeah, I think what'll happen, we're heading towards a boiling point. As bubbles keep coming up one at a time and rippling the surface of the water, you get more and more disturbed water, but at some point it turns into a rolling boil and you can't ignore it any longer, lest it spill over the edges, right? So we're going to get to that at some point in time. There will likely be a catalyst. I can't even fathom as to what will be the ultimate tipping point.
My money's on a hospital.
Well, and here's the thing. They've hit some hospitals already, but I think that it's going to be some sort of significant casualty event. So it's either going to be something like somebody does impact a freshwater supply station and cranks up.
Or natural gas.
Cranks like up the outbound chemicals or something in them and a bunch of people get poisoned, ill, people start to perish, etc. I think we'll run into some sort of event like that at some point in time. Somebody will do something extremely callous and brazen and will trigger a significant response.
Well, I can't edit any of this out now because of that absolutely beautiful boiling water analogy you just did there. That description has to be shared to as wide of an audience as we can. So all six of the people listening to this, you get to hear that. You're listening to the Fearless Paranoia Podcast. We're here to help make the complex language of cybersecurity understandable. So if there are topics or issues that you'd like Ryan and I to break down in an episode, send us an email at info@fearlessparanoia.com or reach out to us on Facebook or LinkedIn. For more information about today's episode, be sure to check out fearlessparanoia.com, where you'll find a full transcript as well as links to helpful resources and any research and reports discussed during the episode. While you're there, check out our other posts and podcasts as well as additional helpful resources for learning about cybersecurity. Now, back to the show. Let's talk more specifically about something you alluded to during that discussion, which is ransomware as a service. Most people are familiar with the concept of software as a service. It is how you're getting price gouged for all of the things that you use now. And it's how you're going to get price gouged for a lot of the things that you take for granted now, like air conditioning in your car. But ransomware as a service. First, Ryan, tell us about it, and then I have some follow-up questions for you.
Well, I mean, again, to what we kind of explained earlier, it's changing ransomware from being a self-contained system within the gang itself, being the developer, the deployer, the collector, the operational unit. It's now just distributed, right? So before, we always had IT departments with, they would set up data centers in their own offices or standalone data centers. They would have to build out all their own infrastructure, just operate their business. And then we saw the distributed cloud come about, where now you can just go and purchase compute, purchase storage. You basically are renting the service from a provider online. And ransomware's, it's really no different than that now. So now ransomware as a service, anybody who wants to be a new black hat can effectively go and purchase initial access from a access broker into a business and then can purchase their way into an affiliate program with a ransomware gang, which means you'll get potentially some information on how to use the ransomware, the newest, latest copy of it, maybe a list of good targets to go after that they've kind of pre-approved. I don't know, maybe a t-shirt or, you know, a branded cup or something. And then they send you on your way after your targets. And the whole goal is here, we'll supply you with all these tools to get in and do this. We'll supply you with the knowledge of how to operationalize all this and how to stay relatively safe. And then you're going to come back and give us our 10, 15, 20, 25% cut, whatever, of whatever you get. And that means you take on the risk, you take on a good chunk of the dirty work, and then we just build the tools. So the ransomware gangs now are, in for the most part, effectively just, they're weapons manufacturers, right? Think of them like Stark Industries. This is basically what they are, right? They're just kind of the sexy front end of war machines.
Yeah, it's kind of funny you're saying the idea of branded merchandise. I've actually thought one of the wild things that I saw was they have IT departments. Some of these ransomware as a service, you can call up their IT department and they will help you with your IT setup. They have PR departments. They can actually work with you and even the people that you've hacked on how to, you know, deal with PR statements. But I do think the coup de grace on that whole thing was, if you were doing it all while you also had a koozie that had the ransomware gang's name on it, I think that would probably be the ultimate in middle fingers to all of our victims, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it also does mean that you'll most likely have to get a new koozie every couple of years, though, because most of those gangs don't tend to be very long-lived in the end, whether it's because they...
Oh, but then you got the vintage merchandise.
I suppose, yeah. The new ransomware eBay.
So let's move on from ransomware as a service, which is frightening to me, this idea that anyone who is able to pay the fee and willing to shoulder the risk can simply buy in to this expertise. But the reality is, Ryan, it was going to happen anyways. The money is there. This was always bound to be where we ended up with this, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, until there gets to be some direct impact to the amount of money that businesses are willing to pay to restore themselves back to operational status, or until there's some sort of disruption to this whole event as a whole, or it's made illegal to even pay the ransoms. Even if businesses end up having to go under, if they're not allowed to pay for something like this, I mean, that changes the game, right? Because then ransomware gangs are going to see a huge reduction in the amount that they can actually pull in. All they're going to be doing is destroying businesses. And like, in the end, that doesn't accomplish their goals, because while all of them aren't going to, if they're a bunch of Russian gangs, cry over American businesses being shuttered, that's not a big deal. But that's not their main goal either. They're in this for financial improvement.
Yeah. It's a poor parasite that kills its host.
Yeah. So the game will just change again, right? They'll just either change to new targets, they'll move to other countries where they can profit, they will find other things to do. Could be instead that maybe they just go around and instead of ransomware, they just go through and they exfil data and then they just work on selling data until that becomes...
So let me ask then, is that all of the stuff that's happening in the presence of these do not pay laws, these do not pay clauses, everything like that, despite all of that, despite the, and it has been a massive rise ever since 2020, the presence of do not pay or will not pay clauses in laws, contracts, insurance has skyrocketed. And yet so has actual payouts. Are we really looking at people who it's do as I say, not as I do? And that it's just a bunch of people who are like, well, of course, I'm willing to be principled on this matter, but understand this is my data now. So I'm, of course, principled, but I'm going to pay the ransom because it's me being impacted. Is that what we're really looking at? Or is this a situation where the do not pay laws themselves are just so simple and basic in their punishment mechanisms that they're just being ignored?
Well, I mean, that's probably going to be. So you, again, so businesses are risk judgment and risk calculation is a big part of business success and just maintaining continuity of a business. And so if you get to a point where you want to collect from a business, you either have to provide them a service offering, you have to buy a large portion of the business to pull money out of it, or you need to find a way to get them to pay you for something. So in this case, it's weird to say it, but they're paying for a service, right? What they're doing is they're paying for restoration of the systems that have been disrupted. It's unfortunate that it's extortions. They're paying the disruptors, but that's how they sell the service to you, right? Is by disrupting and then forcing you to pay. Well, at some point, businesses will have to come to the decision when they're down of either pay the ransom, that's the risk we're going to take, don't pay the ransom and deal with whatever the fallout of that is, or pay the ransom and then have to deal with whatever the legislation or whatever the punishments are there. So again, to them, if they have to look at something like, let's say, a do not pay law, and let's just say it says for every instance that you pay for ransomware because you're not permitted to or you're legally obligated not to, that then you have to pay in addition some sort of fine up to 10% the amount of the ransom or something, right? So they just look at it as, okay, this is just an extra cost for the service, and they just line item it in because that's what business does. Business needs to get back to running business.
Yep.
If not paying means that they're going to be down for 3 days, but if paying means they're going to be down for 1 day, what they need to do is they sit down and they do calculations then. They calculate, what's it going to cost us to be down for 1 day? What's it going to cost us to be down for 3 days? Will the cost of paying the ransom on day one weigh or outweigh the amount of total loss over 3 days instead? And that brings them down to an answer of, is it financially worthwhile for us to pay this ransom? Because we're going to lose so much that it overtakes the amount that we have to pay for the ransom plus the amount that we have to pay for the fine. They might just say, well, we might just make 5 times that in profit. Okay, cool. Well, then we just chalk it up as an additional line item and you just go back about business, right? So yeah, in absence of toothy enough legislation is one of the main detractors from seeing this number continue to trend back downwards.
One other thing, when I think about this particular issue, though, is I also think that the do not pay laws and rules and everything like that take an outdated mindset into this problem. I think they are primarily dealing with ransomware gangs that come into your system, lock up your data, and say, you can't operate until we unlock it. Because the reality is, I think that in modern ransomware, where the biggest and most influential form of extortion is, I have your data, you know what's in there, I'm going to start releasing it, is the most effective way of getting you to pay, that this notion that you are going to obstinately refuse to pay at all costs, no matter what gets released. And let's take this a step further than that, your customers, your clients, people who have some level of influence over you because of your dependence on them for your business to operate, could be calling you and saying, wait, they're going to publish what? Oh, hell no. You had better pay the ransom. So, I mean, Ryan, am I crazy when I think that this idea that you would not only build in the cost of any potential penalty, but realize that not paying might be a bigger reputational hit or internal problem with your own customers than paying might be?
I want to say yes, but the real answer at the short end is no, because realistically, all that really is just one more line item, one more variable in the calculation, right? So again, if you're going
to... This is what happens when you try to talk emotional things with a math person. I want to make that point very clear right now.
So again, not to discount anybody that's on the victim end, right? Or even a second level or third level victim. You know, maybe not even from the company that got impacted, but a customer of theirs, or it was a customer of theirs, and then that was their database that got tapped too. And so now you're talking like a third level victim. But it really comes down to, again, business needs to determine, is this reputational impact really going to stop the customer from buying from us? If the answer is really no, then most of the businesses probably just sit back and they say, F it, we're not going to pay. We're going to let them leak the data. And you know what? These people are still going to come and buy the stuff that we sell anyways, or the service that we sell anyways, because they don't have a better alternative, or because we're the best at what we do or whatever. And it's just not going to be that damaging. Or they can say,
I think there's one industry, though, I think that might get challenged in, and that's healthcare. And the only reason I say that is because of the way the Health and Human Services has come down on companies who have, any one of you who've gotten a letter in the mail about the Facebook pixel, about your doctor's office that used the Facebook pixel, and therefore anything that you entered into your secure portal with your doctor, even if you didn't submit it, all you had to do is type it in and Facebook hoovered it up because of their kernel that they put on these websites. There are such significant penalties coming down for companies that unknowingly allowed this pixel that I wonder if that it might be enough to impact behavior. There's probably a lot we could talk about further on this, but I think you're right. It's going to be a business decision, just like everything else. Let's face it, complying with anti-corruption laws and anti-bribery laws are a business decision. Businesses in the U.S. know that they will be severely punished, which is why they only in very narrow circumstances will pay bribes that companies from other countries do all the time. It's called the Foreign Corrupt Trade Practices Act, and it carries significant penalties. But if they think they can get away with it, or they think that the risk is worth it, they'll still do it.
Well, that's just it, right? Profitability is one big equation in the end. And those are all just different variables. And so again, if it's not going to negatively impact profitability more than an alternative, then you stick with the course. Only if all of a sudden the penalty is toothy enough to say, well, hey, no, if we do get caught in this, or if this does impact us, we will lose so much that we can't survive, then a business will turn around and go, okay, cool, let's look for alternatives, because we're not going to be willing to risk profitability to that level. That's really where you need to hit them. And that's also why ransomware gangs don't typically go out after the fact and release data for people that have paid, even though they very well could. They typically don't, because, you know, you have to have some level of honor among thieves in order to get people to continue to still pay. Because the first ransomware gang that goes out and still releases the stuff even after people have paid, that word gets out and then nobody trusts them anymore, which means they all stop paying them pretty quick.
You have to have at least a reasonable expectation that you are paying for something. Even if it's not actually what they claim, you have to have a reasonable belief that what you're paying has some impact. Yeah, otherwise there's no reason to do it. All right, everybody, that's all the time we have here for Fearless Paranoia. This has been, in my opinion, a fantastic episode. This is a lot of really interesting and useful information. Given that I'm apparently just internally resistant to actually ever scripting this close, I'll throw it to Ryan.
Check out our website, fearlessparanoia.com. Hit us up on social media. Tell everybody else about the cool stuff that you heard here. For those people that you want to punish by having them listen to Brian and I ramble for an hour, send it off to them. It can be like user training. It's a wonderful thing.
Sounds good. Anyways, for Fearless Paranoia, I'm Brian.
And I'm Ryan.
And we'll see you next time.